Ever wonder what truly defines luxury in our modern world? I mean, is it simply about the price tag or maybe the exclusive label? Or is there something, you know, deeper, almost an alchemical process at play that creates this enduring desire? Today, we're not just looking at a company. We're trying to understand how one single entity can really master this art. We're embarking on a deep dive into LVMH Moët Hennessy Louis Vuitton SE. Now, you've given us a stack of really insightful sources here, comprehensive investment analyses, company reports, the works. And our mission, it's pretty clear. We want to extract the most important nuggets for you, give you a shortcut to being truly well-informed, and, well, uncover the strategic brilliance behind this global empire. Think of it as your express lane, maybe, to understanding the economic engine driving some of the world's most coveted brands. How does one company manage to foster, you know, fierce independence and creative autonomy for over 75 distinct luxury brands, some with centuries of heritage, some cutting edge and new, while simultaneously leveraging the immense power, the resources, the sheer scale of a global conglomerate?
That's kind of the paradox we're diving into today.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here, right from the start, it isn't just the sheer scale of LVMH. I mean, 75 prestigious brands, over 215,000 employees worldwide. That's massive, but it's unique and very deliberate approach. It's all about encapsulating the Western art de vivre, as they call it. And they do that by fostering the long-term development and really respecting the unique identity of each of its maisons. So it's much more than just a collection of brands. It's a carefully curated ecosystem. It really embodies a certain aspirational lifestyle.
Right. So if you're curious about how a company can not only dominate an industry that's built on exclusivity and aspiration, but also how it navigates these huge global shifts in taste, technology, economics, and does it with such consistent success, well, then this deep dive is definitely for you. Okay, let's kick things off by maybe painting a picture of this empire's foundations. LVMH, Moët Hennessy, Louis Vuitton SE, as we know it today. It was forged back in 1987, wasn't it?
That's right, in 1987, through the merger of, well, two icons, really.
The fashion house Louis Vuitton.
Yeah, and the wines and spirits producer, Moët Hennessy.
Headquartered, unsurprisingly, in Paris, France. And it operates this just astonishing retail network. Over 6,300 stores globally.
It's huge. Over 6,300.
But this wasn't just like a standard corporate transaction, was it? It felt bigger, more like a grand strategic chess move.
It absolutely was. I mean, this particular merger, it wasn't just two luxury giants coming together. It was really the birth of a very deliberate, very long-term strategy. The goal, to become the undisputed global leader in luxury goods. Simple as that. And their mission statement, you mentioned it, it's incredibly insightful. It really acts as a guiding star for, well, pretty much everything they do. It's about representing the most refined qualities of Western art de vivre.
That phrase again.
Exactly. While simultaneously ensuring the long-term development and respecting the unique identity of each of its maisons. That's their term for the individual brands.
Right. The maisons.
This isn't a company driven by, you know, hitting quarterly numbers for its brands. It's entirely about perpetual brand cultivation, nurturing these legacies for generations, allowing them to really flourish.
It's quite a vision, isn't it? I mean, imagine a company that spans from the oldest champagne houses, literally steeped in centuries of tradition.
Yeah.
To the most cutting-edge beauty brands embracing rapid innovation, all under one umbrella, yet each somehow maintaining its distinct voice, its creative vision. It's a testament to this unique approach. So, okay, 75 brands across six pillars. That's an incredible portfolio. But how is this vast, diversified empire actually structured? And what roles do these different segments play within the whole?
Okay, so it's structured into six core business groups. And you're right, each one is a powerhouse in its own right, holding some of the world's most desired brands, contributing to the overall strength, and crucially, the diversification of the group.
All right, let's start at the roots, maybe quite literally, with wines and spirits. This segment feels foundational, doesn't it? Part of the company's heritage. What's its unique strategic role within the broader LVMH portfolio today?
You're absolutely right. It's foundational, both historically and strategically. I mean, the segment boasts just an unparalleled portfolio of premium champagnes. Think Moët and Chandon, Dom Pérignon, Veuve Clicquot, Krug, Ruinart. Names just synonymous with celebration.
The big hitters.
Definitely. And on the spirits side, Hennessy is the undisputed global leader in cognac. Plus, they have prestigious Scotch whiskies like Glenmorangie and Ardbeg, Belvedere Vodka, and high-end wines like the legendary Chateau Dequem. Now, beyond just the revenue they bring in, these brands really embody heritage, craftsmanship, tradition, core values LVMH champions across all its maisons. And strategically, they often represent a very consistent, very reliable cash flow generator for the group.
Okay, makes sense. And then we move to what many people probably consider the beating heart of LVMH, fashion and leather goods. Why is this segment so absolutely crucial to their overall success?
Yeah, this is without a doubt the group's largest and most profitable division. It really serves as its primary engine of growth and value creation. It's home to global mega brands like Louis Vuitton and Christian Dior, obviously.
The giants.
The giants, yes. But it also includes other highly coveted maisons. Think Fendi, Celine, Loro Piana, Givenchy, Loewe, Rimowa, Berluti. These brands are often the trendsetters. They drive cultural conversations. They generate immense desire. And that translates directly into, well, outsized financial performance. Their innovation, their creative vision, their global appeal gets paramount.
Next up, the perfumes and cosmetics segment. This feels like, I don't know, a bridge maybe, bringing in both heritage and innovation and perhaps attracting new consumer segments.
That's an excellent way to put it, actually, a bridge. This segment brings together globally renowned maisons with a strong focus on fragrances, makeup, skincare. Mm-hmm. So you'll find the heritage brands like Parfums Christian Dior, Guerlain, Parfums Givenchy, Kenzo Parfums. But importantly, it also features innovative, really high growth brands. Think Benefit Cosmetics, Makeup Forever, Fresh, and the incredibly successful Fenty Beauty by Rihanna, alongside niche players like Maison Francis Kurkdjian.
Fenty's huge. Massive. And this strategic mix allows LVMH to capture newer trends, engage younger audiences, and crucially, offer more accessible entry points into the whole luxury world.
Okay, now onto the realm of hard luxury watches and jewelry. This category has seen some pretty significant strategic moves and growth recently, hasn't it?
It has indeed. This segment has grown significantly in importance for LVMH, especially following that landmark acquisition of Tiffany & Co.
Right, Tiffany. That was huge news.
Huge. So it includes iconic jewelry maisons like Bouvelgari, Tiffany & Co. itself, Chaumet, and Fred, all synonymous with enduring value, craftsmanship. And for watchmaking, you have prestigious Swiss brands, Tag Heuer, Hublot, Zenith. This category, you know, represents significant long-term investment value for consumers, which makes it a particularly resilient part of the portfolio.
In the selective retailing segment, we see names like Sephora and DFS here. This isn't just about selling products, is it? It seems like it's more about crafting the entire luxury shopping experience itself. What strategic purpose does this serve for LVMH beyond just the direct sales?
You've hit on a crucial point there. It's precisely about creating unique and, importantly, personalized luxury retail experiences. Sephora, which is the world's leading beauty retailer, is a massive part of this.
Sephora is everywhere.
Absolutely. Right. Along with DFS, a real pioneer in luxury travel retail. This segment also includes those iconic Parisian department stores, Le Bon Marché Rive Gauche and La Samaritaine, offering these curated, super high-end shopping environments. But beyond the direct revenue, these channels serve as really strategic customer acquisition pathways. They introduce a broader audience to LVMH-owned brands, and they nurture loyalty from a really early stage. It's clever.
Very clever.
Yeah.
Okay, finally, the other activities category. This is a wonderfully eclectic mix, isn't it? It really embodies that broader art de vivre philosophy you mentioned. But what's the common thread? What ties luxury yachts to leading French newspapers and these ultra-exclusive hotels?
Well, the common thread is that relentless commitment to excellence and that art de vivre, extending beyond traditional luxury goods into, well, a whole lifestyle. So this segment includes the luxury hospitality groups Belmond and Cheval Blanc.
Amazing property.
Truly. Thing. The high-end yacht builder Royal Van Lent, and even French media outlets like Les Echos and Le Parisien. These diverse businesses, they all contribute to LVMH's holistic vision of luxury, capturing a broader share of high net worth consumer spending on experiences, on information. And what's truly compelling, I think, is how each of these distinct segments, while having its own market and identity, ultimately contributes to the overall LVMH ecosystem. This isn't random diversification. It's a deliberate integrated strategy. It's about capturing market share across the entire luxury spectrum and offering a complete lifestyle.
That's quite the list of iconic names spread across a remarkably diverse set of businesses. It's impressive.
Yeah.
But how do these individual powerhouses actually contribute to the overall financial strength of LVMH? I mean, are they all pulling equal weight? Are they all equally profitable? Or does one segment truly act as the financial engine of this vast enterprise?
Ah, that's a critical question. And the answer is a resounding no, not equally. Not at all. If we look at the 2024 figures, the group's total revenue was 84,683 million, let's call it 84.7 billion euros, with a profit from recurring operations of 19,571 million, nearly 19.6 billion. That leads to an overall operating margin for the group of 23.1%. Pretty healthy.
Okay, 23.1% overall. But break it down for us. Where does the real financial punch come from?
Okay, so here's where it gets granular and incredibly revealing. The fashion and leather goods division, remember, Louis Vuitton, Dior, Fendi.
The heart of the operation.
Exactly. That division alone brought in 41,060 million in revenue, about 41 billion euros, which is approximately 48% of the group's total revenue.
Wow. Okay, so nearly half the revenue from just one division. But what about the profit contribution? That's usually where the true story lies, isn't it?
Precisely. That's the kicker. That same fashion and leather goods segment generated an astounding 15,230 million in profit from recurring operations. Over 15 billion euros. Do you know what percentage of the group's total profit that is?
I'm guessing high.
Over 77%.
77%.
From one division.
77%. Its operating margin stood at a remarkable 37.1%. Now, just to put that into perspective, compared to the operating margins of the other segments, wines and spirits, respectable at 23.1%, perfumes and cosmetics, much lower at 8.0%, watches and jewelry, 14.6%, selective retailing, 7.6%.
Huh?
The disparity is stark, really stark.
What's truly striking is that disproportionate profit contribution from fashion and leather goods. I mean, it's huge. So if I'm picturing this correctly, this segment isn't just profitable. It's effectively a colossal cash engine for the whole group. How does that kind of financial firepower create a strategic advantage for the entire LVMH group? You've captured the essence of it perfectly. The data clearly indicates fashion and leather goods is the cornerstone. It generates disproportionately high profit and crucially cash flow. And this creates what people often call a powerful flywheel effect.
The flywheel effect.
Right, exactly. The enormous, reliable cash flows coming from those mega brands like Louis Vuitton and Christian Dior are strategically reinvested across the entire group. They're used to nurture the smaller emerging brands. Think low, think Rimowa, giving them the time, the creative freedom, the substantial resources they need to develop their unique identities and market positions without that immediate pressure to hit blockbuster numbers.
Patient capital.
Patient capital, precisely. And this capital is also the war chest for those transformative acquisitions we talked about, like the $15.8 billion purchase of Tiffany & Co. back in 2021. Or acquiring the Belmond Hotel Group, which diversifies the portfolio into luxury experiences. This self-funded growth allows for that patient, long-term brand building. It's a strategic luxury that smaller, independent competitors simply cannot afford. And for you, the listener, this isn't just about LVMH, it's a powerful lesson. It shows how a diversified business can leverage its strongest assets to strategically strengthen and expand its entire portfolio. It allows for those patient, long-term investments that others just can't match.
That structural advantage, that flywheel effect, it's truly brilliant. It allows for a flexibility and a long-term vision that's, frankly, rare in today's market.
Which brings us nicely to the very art of brand building for LVMH, their portfolio strategy. You said it's not just a collection of brands, it's a meticulously structured house of brands designed to capture consumers across the entire luxury spectrum. How does this multi-tiered approach actually work in practice? Right. It's meticulously curated. LVMH positions its portfolio across the entire luxury spectrum with a very deliberate strategy. It's designed to engage a wide demographic and capture market share at various price points and levels of aspiration. You can almost think of it as a ladder of luxury with distinct tiers.
Okay, so let's start at the bottom rung, maybe. What they call accessible or aspirational luxury. Where does that fit in and what role does it play strategically?
So brands like Sephora and Benefit Cosmetics are perfect examples of this entry point. They serve as an invitation, really, into the LVMH universe for a broad consumer base. Sephora, for instance, it isn't just a revenue stream, though it's a massive one. It's a strategic customer acquisition channel.
Right, getting people in the door.
Exactly. By providing a positive retail experience and introducing consumers to LVMH-owned perfume and cosmetic brands like Dior, Guerlain, Fenty Beauty, it builds familiarity.
Yeah.
It builds loyalty to the LVMH ecosystem from an early age. It's an incredibly clever way to cultivate future luxury buyers.
So accessible luxury acts almost as a gateway, an invitation. That makes sense.
Right.
Like a consumer starting with a Fenty lipstick today could, over time, maybe aspire to a Louis Vuitton handbag.
Right.
Or even a Tiffany diamond eventually. It's like, LVMH has built this luxury ladder for long-term loyalty and brand progression, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So then we move up into core luxury. This is probably what most people instantly think of when they hear LVMH.
Precisely. This is where brands like Louis Vuitton, Dior, Celine, Tag Heuer operate. These maisons cater directly to affluent and high net worth individuals. They are the consistent performers, the iconic names that represent established, enduring luxury. They set trends, they define aspirations, and then at the very apex of this ladder, we find the absolute luxury segment.
Right, where price is almost secondary. Yep. Things like heritage, craftsmanship, and just pure exclusivity.
Exactly. Maisons such as Loro Piana, Beauvais, Chateau Dicam, and the highest jewelry collections from Tiffany & Co., they serve the ultra-high net worth clientele. For these customers, price is genuinely secondary to unparalleled craftsmanship, bespoke experiences, deep heritage, and extreme exclusivity. And this multi-tiered approach, it provides significant resilience to LVMH, because weakness in the aspirational segment, maybe during an economic downturn, can often be offset by continued strength and consistent demand at the very top end of the market. It's a beautifully engineered system for enduring market presence.
That multi-tiered approach to luxury is incredibly clever.
Yeah.
But here's the fascinating paradox we touched on earlier. How do they keep so many diverse brands feeling unique, authentic, independent, each with its own creative vision, while simultaneously benefiting from being part of such a giant group? It almost seems contradictory, doesn't it? Maintaining that artisanal soul at such a massive scale.
It does seem contradictory on the surface, absolutely. But LVMH's business model masterfully balances these two seemingly opposing forces. It combines a decentralized operational structure with powerful centralized synergies, creating what's often referred to as the conglomerate advantage. It's a strategic tightrope walk they execute with, frankly, remarkable precision.
Okay, so on one hand, there's this fierce decentralized autonomy for each brand. Explain that a bit more.
Absolutely. So each of the 75 maisons operates with a significant degree of autonomy. This is crucial. It's crucial for preserving its unique creative identity, its rich heritage, its distinct culture. In the luxury sector, the authenticity and the distinct story of each brand are paramount to its desirability. So creative directors are empowered to push boundaries, ensuring the brands remain culturally relevant, innovative, and deeply connected to their specific customer base. They absolutely do not want a corporate feel bleeding into any of their brands.
Okay, that makes sense. Protect the brand DNA. But then these individual brands get to tap into the immense resources of the LVMH mothership, which brings us to these powerful centralized synergies. What are some practical examples of how the group leverages its size for the benefit of all its brands?
Oh, the benefits are truly vast and incredibly powerful. First, there's immense financial strength. Each brand has ready access to capital for investment, for new flagship stores, manufacturing enhancements, big marketing campaigns at a much lower cost than if they were independent entities.
Cheaper borrowing, basically.
Essentially, yes. Then consider real estate leverage. LVMH has just unmatched power in negotiating for prime retail locations globally. They secure the most prestigious shopping districts, you know, from Paris's Avenue Montaigne to New York's Fifth Avenue, Tokyo's Ginza, Dubai Mall. Everywhere that matters. They also foster a deep pool of executive and creative talent. This talent to be shared and rotated across the group's maisons, which fosters internal development, and it allows for the cross-pollination of best practices and innovative ideas between brands.
And I imagine something like supply chain management would be a huge advantage too, for efficiency and maybe quality control.
It's absolutely critical. There's shared expertise and significant investment in craftsmanship, sourcing, production, including vertical integration through the acquisition of key suppliers. For example, LVMH might acquire a specialist Italian tannery like they did with Nudi Evo. That ensures a consistent supply of high-quality raw materials for their leather goods brands.
Controlling the source.
Exactly. Guaranteeing both quality and ethical sourcing standards. And finally, in this digital age, media and marketing benefits immensely. They have collective bargaining power for global media buying. They have shared digital expertise, which is incredibly valuable for navigating today's complex data-driven marketing landscape. So if we connect this to the bigger picture, as you say, it's about balancing two seemingly contradictory ideas: the unique artisanal soul and creative freedom of an individual brand with the undeniable operational and financial power of a global corporation. It's really a masterclass in strategic management. It allows for both agility and scale.
That's an incredible balancing act.
Mm-hmm.
It really demonstrates how LVMH optimizes for both individual brand identity and that collective strength. It sounds like they are, you know, perfectly positioned within the global luxury landscape. So let's zoom out a bit now. What does that broader landscape look like today? What are the key forces shaping its trajectory?
Well, the global luxury market is truly vast, and it continues to expand its reach. According to Bain & Company, who tracked this closely, the total market for luxury goods and experiences reached an estimated $1.5 trillion in 2023. That set a new record.
1.5 trillion euros.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's enormous. Now, this personal luxury goods segment, that's the core for LVMH. Fashion, leather goods, watches, jewelry, beauty, that alone hit $362 billion in 2023. Also huge.
But we've been hearing a lot about a slowdown recently, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
Especially after that incredible boom during and immediately after the pandemic. What's going on there?
Yes, you're absolutely right. After several years of just exceptional post-pandemic growth, the market definitely entered a phase of, let's call it, normalization in late 2023, and that's continued into 2024. This moderation is driven by a confluence of factors, really. Macroeconomic uncertainty, persistent inflation impacting those aspirational consumers we talked about, and also just challenging comparisons to the prior year's supercharged growth. It couldn't last forever.
Right. Gravity eventually kicks in.
Exactly. So Bain & Company forecasts a relatively softer performance for 2024 and 2025. Growth expected to be in the low to mid single digits. So slower, but still growth. What's important to note, though, even within this normalization, is that the industry is undergoing significant consolidation. The largest, most powerful groups led by LVMH are steadily gaining market share. Get this. In 2022, the top 10 luxury companies generated a remarkable 63% of the year-on-year sales growth.
63%?
Yeah.
From just 10 companies.
And 76% of the combined net profit of the top 100 luxury companies globally. This trend really underscores the increasing dominance of scaled players with formidable resources. The big are getting bigger.
So what does this all mean for the future of luxury and LVMH's positioning within it? Are there powerful long-term tailwinds or secular growth drivers, as they say, that are really shaping demand even beyond these cyclical fluctuations we're seeing now?
Oh, absolutely. Despite any near-term cyclical headwinds, the long-term outlook for luxury remains incredibly robust. It's supported by several powerful, enduring secular growth drivers. The first, and arguably most important, is simply global wealth creation. The relentless expansion of the global affluent and high net worth population is the primary engine here. We're seeing rising disposable incomes in dynamic emerging economies, particularly across Asia and the Middle East, creating millions of new potential luxury consumers every year. Chinese consumers, for example, are forecast to account for a staggering 35-40% of all personal luxury goods purchases by 2030.
35-40% just from Chinese consumers. That's incredible.
It's a huge concentration. Yes, a testament to their growing influence.
And what about demographics? We hear a lot about younger generations. Are the luxury buyers getting younger, and how does that impact the industry?
They certainly are. The luxury consumer base is getting progressively younger. Millennials and Generation Z are rapidly becoming the industry's primary engine for future growth. They are projected to represent a combined 75-85% of the market by 2030.
Wow, three quarters or more.
Exactly. And these cohorts, they bring new values and expectations. They prioritize sustainability, authentic digital engagement, unique brand stories, and meaningful experiences, often over mere tangible ownership. And the shift directly leads to another critical driver, digital transformation. The acceleration of online channels and digitally influenced sales, hugely amplified by the pandemic, is becoming increasingly important. E-commerce and digitally influenced purchases are expected to account for something like two-thirds of the market by 2030.
Two-thirds online or influenced online. That's massive.
Yeah.
It is. And this necessitates a seamless omni-channel strategy. One that profoundly integrates physical stores with sophisticated digital platforms, offering personalized and engaging customer journeys from start to finish.
And finally, the experience economy. That seems to be a huge trend, not just for luxury, but across consumer spending generally. How is that playing out in this specific sector?
It's a transformative trend for luxury, too. Affluent consumers are increasingly allocating their discretionary spending towards luxury experiences. Things like fine dining, bespoke travel, exclusive events, high-end wellness, often choosing these over purely tangible goods. And LVMH's strategic expansion into high-end hospitality with its Belmond and Cheval Blanc hotel brands, and its recent partnership with Accor to redevelop the iconic Orient Express train.
The Orient Express, right.
Exactly. These are direct and very deliberate responses to this structural shift towards experiences. It's not just random diversification. It's about creating a holistic luxury ecosystem, capturing a larger share of wallet from its most valuable clients, and deepening brand engagement beyond just a simple retail transaction. And this raises an important question, doesn't it? How does a venerable company, rooted in heritage and craftsmanship, adapt to these massive generational shifts in consumer values, especially with younger cohorts who demand more than just a product they want, a purpose, and experience? LVMH's proactive strategy here is really a prime example of forward-thinking adaptation, not just chasing trends, but anticipating and actually shaping them.
It really does sound like LVMH is truly future-proofing its business model by adapting so proactively to these long-term trends. But even at this scale, they operate within a competitive arena. You mentioned consolidation, but they still have rivals. Who are their key adversaries, and perhaps more importantly, what are the inherent moats that allow LVMH to maintain its dominant edge in such a competitive yet consolidating market?
You're right to ask about the competition, absolutely. But it's important to frame it correctly. LVMH's sheer scale and diversification really place it in a league of its own, financially speaking. With that 2023 revenue of $86.2 billion, it's significantly larger than its primary publicly traded competitors.
Okay, so bearing that scale in mind, who are these key adversaries and what are their distinct strategies? How do they differ?
Well, there's Hermès, for example. They're positioned at the absolute apex of the luxury pyramid, a single ultra-exclusive brand. Their model is built on artificial scarcity, unparalleled craftsmanship, and timeless products like the Birkin and Kelly bags, which are often seen as investment-grade assets themselves.
Right. Almost impossible to get a hold of sometimes.
Exactly. Hermès caters primarily to the ultra-wealthy and is often considered the most profitable and least cyclically sensitive in the sector because of that extreme scarcity. Then you have Kering. Another multi-brand group, but its fortunes have been heavily tied to its flagship brand, Gucci. Kering has faced some challenges recently. Brand fatigue at Gucci, higher exposure to the more fickle, aspirational consumer. It's led to some underperformance compared to peers.
Okay. And what about Richemont? They seem more focused.
They are. Richemont is another significant conglomerate, but largely focused on hard luxury. Their strength lies in iconic jewelry maisons like Cartier and Van Cleef & Arpels, and a portfolio of prestigious Swiss watchmakers, Vacheron Constantin, Jaeger LeCoultre, and others. And, of course, we can't forget Chanel, a truly formidable competitor, though privately held.
Right, so less public data on them.
Exactly. Their financial details are less transparent, but they're an undeniable powerhouse across fashion, leather goods, beauty, high jewelry, with a fiercely independent brand image. And interestingly, the current market slowdown we discussed, it's actually accentuating a phenomenon often called a flight to quality.
Flight to quality, meaning?
Meaning in times of economic uncertainty, consumers, especially the discerning affluent ones, gravitate towards the most established, iconic, desirable brands, the ones perceived to hold their value. This tends to benefit mega brands like Louis Vuitton and Christian Dior at LVMH and also Hermès, while it disproportionately harms more trend-driven or accessible luxury brands that rely more heavily on discretionary spending.
That really highlights something crucial, doesn't it? That in luxury, it's not just about having a great product. It's about having the history, controlling your own destiny through distribution, and having the financial muscle to weather any storm. These seem like critical factors for any business, and LVMH's competitive moats here seem incredibly strong.
They truly are formidable. The barriers to entry in this market are exceptionally high, creating these durable competitive advantages, these moats for LVMH. First, think about brand heritage and legacy. The most powerful luxury brands have histories spanning over a century that imbues them with an authenticity, a narrative, a timelessness. You just can't manufacture that overnight. It gives them an almost mythical status.
Can't just invent a century of history.
Right, exactly. Then there's scale and financial power. The enormous capital required for consistent global advertising, securing prime retail locations everywhere, investing in world-class manufacturing, nurturing top-tier talent, it's prohibitive for new entrants. And finally, control of distribution. Vertically integrated players like LVMH control their own retail networks. That allows them to meticulously manage the customer experience, maintain pricing integrity, no discounting, and capture the full retail margin. That's vital for profitability and brand image. Ultimately, these moats, the unparalleled scale, the deep diversification, those irreplaceable brand assets, and the immense financial strength they allow LVMH to invest strategically right through economic cycles, further solidifying its leadership position.
So the financial prowess of LVMH is clearly a major, major advantage. It underpins so much of its strategy and allows for those incredibly robust moats. Let's really drill down into their financial performance now. Look over the last decade, maybe, and understand how they manage all that immense capital.
Okay, so over the past decade, LVMH has delivered a powerful and actually accelerating trajectory of revenue growth. It's a real testament to its market dominance and strategic execution. From 2015 to 2023, the group's revenue more than doubled. It grew from about $39.6 billion to that impressive $86.2 billion figure we mentioned. And this growth was particularly strong in the immediate post-pandemic period. Reported revenue jumped by a staggering 44% in 2021 and then another 23% in 2022. Fueled by pent-up consumer demand and also the successful, impactful integration of Tiffany & Co.
It's crucial, though, as you mentioned, with global companies, to distinguish between that reported growth and the organic growth figure. Organic growth strips out currency fluctuations and the impact of M&A, right? What do those details tell us about the underlying health of the business itself?
You've hit on a vital distinction, absolutely vital for any global company. In 2024, for example, LVMH reported a revenue decline of 2%. Now, that might sound concerning at first glance. However, on an organic basis, meaning excluding those currency movements and acquisitions, revenue actually grew by 1%.
So underlying growth was still positive.
Exactly. This divergence was due to a substantial negative impact from foreign exchange rates. It highlights the underlying resilience of the business despite those unfavorable currency movements. The acquisition of Tiffany & Co. in January 2021, of course, provided a significant inorganic boost, especially to the watches and jewelry segment and the group overall. It showcases their ability to execute these large-scale strategic integrations successfully. And this strong top-line growth. It's consistently matched by robust profitability. The group's gross margin has remained remarkably stable in a high band of 66-69% over the past several years. That demonstrates impressive pricing power. And the operating margin typically ranges from a very healthy 23% to 27%.
And again, it's the fashion and leather goods division that's really driving this profitability, isn't it? And
yeah.
That segment pulls a lot of the weight financially.
Without a doubt. Its operating margins have consistently exceeded 35%. They even reached an exceptional 40.6% in 2022. Just incredible profitability. Now, while we did see a slight compression in the group's overall operating margin down to 23.1% in 2024 due to that market normalization and the negative currency effects, this level still remains significantly above pre-pandemic levels, which demonstrates strong cost control, enduring pricing power, and the group's ability to maintain high efficiency even amidst external pressures.
So beyond just reporting these impressive numbers, what does this level of financial efficiency, particularly in cash generation, tell us about LVMH's fundamental strength and how it positions them strategically?
Well, beyond the raw revenue and profit, LVMH consistently demonstrates impressive capital efficiency. That's really a hallmark of a well-managed business. Their return on equity, or ROE, is consistently high recently, around 17.0%. That shows how effectively they generate profits from shareholder capital. And their return on invested capital, ROIC, is also strong at 11.3%. Now, this ROIC figure is particularly insightful because it includes the significant goodwill and intangible assets sitting on their balance sheet from decades of premium acquisitions.
Right. All that money paid above book value for brands.
Exactly. So generating double-digit returns on a capital base that is inflated by the premium prices paid for iconic brands like Tiffany. That's a powerful validation of their acquisition and brand building strategy. It confirms significant economic value creation over time.
And then there's the cash flow. You used the word prodigious earlier. It really is. I recall reading that during the 2020 pandemic, a truly severe global stress test, the fashion and leather goods division saw organic sales fall by only 3%, a mere 3%, yet its operating margin remained an extraordinary 33.9%. And then boom, an explosive rebound, with group revenue growing by nearly 49% in 2021. What does this bounce back ability reveal about LVMH's intrinsic nature? Is it just resilient or something more?
That extraordinary performance during the pandemic and the subsequent rebound demonstrates a profound quality of what Nassim Taleb might call anti-fragility.
Anti-fragility, meaning it gets stronger from shocks.
In a sense, yes. Unlike companies that merely weather a storm, LVMH's core brands often emerge stronger. They gain market share as weaker competitors falter or even disappear. Demand for their core brands during a crisis isn't destroyed, it's merely deferred, leading to outsized growth and market share gains.
Exactly.
Which highlights their incredibly high cash conversion capabilities and financial robustness. Their balance sheet is also exceptionally strong. Net financial debt was down to $9.2 billion in 2024, a 14% decrease from the prior year, and they maintain a conservatively managed debt-to-equity ratio, all of which provides immense financial flexibility.
That level of financial discipline and strength, combined with that anti-fragility, is truly remarkable. It paints a picture of a very well-oiled machine. But with such immense capital at their disposal, the question becomes, how did they decide where to deploy it? Where does all that cash go? What's the guiding philosophy behind LVMH's capital allocation strategy, particularly thinking about it from the perspective of the Arnault family's long-term vision?
Right. LVMH's capital allocation really reflects its long-term family-controlled strategic vision. And that vision prioritizes one overarching goal, maximizing brand desirability above all else. Now, they do have a longstanding policy of returning a significant portion of profits to shareholders through dividends. The dividend CAGR compound annual growth rate was over 23% in the 5 years through 2024. That's strong growth.
Very strong.
The payout ratio is managed prudently, typically between 40 55% of net profit. This allows them to retain substantial capital for future growth initiatives. Share repurchases are more opportunistic. They did $1.5 billion in 2023, $1 billion planned for 2025, primarily for cancellation to boost earnings per share. But dividends are the main return mechanism.
And acquisitions, of course. You mentioned Tiffany, Bulveri, Laura Piana. They're clearly a cornerstone of their growth, and they seem to have an exceptional track record here. That Tiffany acquisition in particular felt like a massive strategic statement.
It was indeed a cornerstone. Acquisitions are a fundamental part of their long-term growth strategy. They have a history of successfully identifying and integrating iconic brands. The acquisition of Tiffany & Co. in 2021 for that $15.8 billion price tag was a profound strategic pivot for the group. It significantly increased LVMH's exposure to the resilient, hard luxury category jewelry, which benefits from more of an investment mindset among consumers.
Seen as holding value better, perhaps.
Precisely. It also bolstered their presence in the crucial U.S. market, diversifying geographic risk. And the results seem to bear it out. We've seen reports of a quadrupling of high jewelry revenue at Tiffany since the acquisition, which strongly validates that bold strategy. They also make smaller tactical bolt-on acquisitions, like that Italian tannery Nudi Evo, for vertical integration, securing high-quality raw materials, reinforcing their supply chain. It's not always about the big headline deals.
But a substantial portion of LVMH's prodigious cash flow is reinvested back into the business itself through capital expenditures or CapEx. In 2024, CapEx amounted to a significant $8.4 billion. That's a lot of investment. What do these investments primarily fund?
These substantial investments fund critical long-term growth drivers, things like new flagship stores and prime global locations, extensive renovations of existing stores like the multi-year, multi-billion-dollar project for Tiffany's The Landmark on Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, it's a huge renovation.
Huge. Also expanding manufacturing capacity to meet demand and building out their digital infrastructure to enhance that crucial omni-channel experience. And crucially, the significant annual investment in marketing and communication, while it's technically an operating expense, it's viewed internally as a critical component of capital allocation. It's aimed squarely at nurturing and elevating long-term brand equity, ensuring desirability for generations to come. This whole disciplined, long-term approach, guided by the Arnault family's philosophy, it truly is active portfolio management at its finest. And what's truly fascinating here, as we discussed, is how this family-controlled structure enables that long-term strategic vision. A vision often missing in public companies driven by quarterly earnings pressures. It allows for those patient capital decisions we mentioned, investing billions in a multi-year store renovation, or nurturing a developing brand for a decade that ultimately build enduring value and reinforce those competitive moats. This is a crucial distinction. Cash flows from mature, highly profitable assets like Louis Vuitton are strategically used to fund the growth of emerging brands, finance new strategic acquisitions, and maintain the world-class infrastructure that benefits the entire portfolio. It's a virtuous cycle.
It's clear that LVMH has an incredibly robust strategy, executed with remarkable financial discipline and that long-term perspective. But no company, not even a luxury titan of this scale, is immune to headwinds and challenges. Nothing's perfect. So let's look at some of the recent developments and hurdles they've faced, particularly from 2023 through 2025, as the market normalizes from those post-pandemic highs.
Indeed, no company is immune. After that period of supercharged growth post-pandemic, the luxury market, and by extension, LVMH, have definitely entered a period of normalization. This period is characterized by more moderate demand, ongoing macroeconomic uncertainty, and those significant currency headwinds we talked about. So management's focus has naturally shifted. It's moved from merely capturing explosive growth to now driving operational efficiency and meticulously reinforcing the desirability of its brands for the long term. preparing for the next phase of expansion whenever that comes.
And the China equation is always a significant factor for global luxury, isn't it? It looms large. What's the latest pulse from that critical market? Especially after the initial hopes for a really strong post-reopening surge didn't quite materialize as expected.
Yeah, it remains a hugely significant and sometimes complex factor, always. The post-reopening recovery in China in 2023 was, well, less robust than many had anticipated, and demand, particularly for Hennessy Cognac, remains somewhat soft into 2024 and 2025 amid a challenging domestic economic environment there. However, management commentary from the first half of 2025 provides some crucial nuance. It's not all doom and gloom. While the headline numbers for Asia were negative, largely due to the reversal of exceptional tourist spending in Japan, actually LVMH noted a tangible sequential improvement in mainland China in the second quarter.
Okay, so some positive signs underneath the surface.
Potentially, yes. Driven by local demand and the repatriation of tourist spending, meaning Chinese consumers spending more at home rather than abroad, this suggests that the underlying trend for the domestic Chinese consumer may be improving, shifting from international travel back to local purchasing. And crucially, their long-term strategy remains focused on the qualitative development of local clientele, not just relying solely on unpredictable tourist flows.
Right. So it's not just about waiting for tourists to flock back in. It's about building a solid, resilient base of local consumers within China. This reflects the broader post-pandemic realities, doesn't it? This talk of big luxury fatigue among some aspirational consumers.
Exactly. The industry is navigating this transition from a boom market to a more normalized growth environment. And this has led to a noticeable bifurcation, a split in consumer behavior. High-end, wealthy consumers have remained remarkably resilient. They're continuing to purchase top-tier, absolute luxury products. However, the aspirational consumer, the one who entered the market in greater numbers in recent years, has pulled back on discretionary spending due to persistent inflation, rising interest rates, overall economic uncertainty.
Feeling the pinch more.
Precisely. This big luxury fatigue phenomenon means those more accessible luxury items are feeling the squeeze more acutely. Geographically, LVMH has reported solid local demand in the United States and Europe, which provides a stable foundation. That's good news. But tourist spending in these regions has been impacted by the strength of the euro and dollar, making goods more expensive for foreign visitors. That adds another layer of complexity to manage.
So LVMH is navigating this normalizing environment with these strategic adaptations, recognizing the shifts in consumer behavior and market dynamics. But beyond these broad market shifts, what are the specific operational pressures they're facing day to day, and how are they strategically responding to them to secure their future?
Okay, from an operational standpoint, currency headwinds have been a significant pressure. We've mentioned it a few times. It's led to a substantial negative impact on both reported revenue and profit. Remember that FY 2024 example, a reported revenue decline of 2% was actually 1% organic growth. That's a 3 percentage point negative impact from currency alone.
Wiping out the growth on paper.
Pretty much. The strong euro against currencies like the US dollar, Japanese yen, Chinese yuan, it reduces the value of sales when translated back, masking underlying strength. Inflation also puts persistent pressure on margins, higher raw material costs, energy, labor, it all adds up. Now, LVMH's formidable pricing power helps offset some of this, but they can't pass on all costs without potentially affecting demand, especially among those aspirational buyers. And while their global supply chain is generally robust, a real source of competitive advantage, the sheer complexity and global reach mean reputational risks do exist. You can't control everything perfectly. For example, there was a recent controversy involving a subcontractor for Loro Piana, one of their brands, regarding working conditions. It brought attention to these issues and highlights the constant scrutiny and need for diligence across their vast network to ensure ethical practices are maintained.
These operational challenges certainly keep even a luxury giant like LVMH on its toes. It's not easy running a global empire. So, what are LVMH's strategic imperatives to tackle these issues and secure its long-term future? Beyond just, you know, weathering a current storm.
Their strategic imperatives are clear and they're multifaceted. First, digital acceleration is paramount, absolutely key. This means a continued push toward a direct-to-consumer model, robust e-commerce platforms, advanced digital clienteling.
Yeah. But it's like personalized service through digital channels.
Exactly. Building deeper relationships, using digital tools, leveraging AI for more personalized marketing, even deploying blockchain for anti-counterfeiting efforts and supply chain transparency. The LVMH Innovation Award also highlights their commitment to partnering with cutting-edge tech startups to stay ahead. Second, sustainability commitments have become a core pillar, really central. It's encapsulated in their Life 360 program, which has ambitious targets for 2026 and 2030 across climate, biodiversity, circularity, transparency. They even achieved a remarkable 55% reduction in energy-related greenhouse gas emissions by 2024, meeting their 2026 target early. Which is impressive.
That's significant progress.
Very. And this is crucial for younger consumers, for regulatory compliance, and just for brand reputation overall. Finally, LVMH sees the current slowdown not just as a challenge, but actually as a strategic opportunity. They're using this period to initiate long-term structural efficiencies, going beyond just short-term cost-cutting. Things like optimizing their retail footprint, enhancing supply chain productivity, streamlining operations for greater agility in the years to come. Playing the long game. And this raises that important question again, doesn't it? How do they maintain that exquisite balance between exclusivity and growth, particularly in a challenging environment? It just shows that even a luxury giant must constantly innovate and adapt, not just to shifting market demand, but also to evolving consumer values around ethics, sustainability, digital engagement. That's a profound strategic imperative for pretty much any business today, luxury or not.
That truly highlights how even at the very top, constant adaptation and innovation are non-negotiable. You can't rest on your laurels. That brings us to a truly crucial, perhaps the defining element of LVMH's long-term success, its management and governance, particularly the enduring influence of the Arnault dynasty.
Absolutely. Bernard Arnault has been at the helm of LVMH since 1989. It's over three decades of stable, consistent, and frankly, visionary leadership. His strategic approach is distinctively long-term. It prioritizes the meticulous cultivation of brand desirability and creative excellence over hitting short-term financial targets. This isn't a leader focused on the next quarter's numbers. It's a leader focused on building enduring legacies that last generations.
And this long-term perspective is a core competitive advantage, as you've said, especially when you consider the family-controlled nature of the group. What makes that family control such a powerful differentiator, particularly in today's market, where public companies often face intense pressure for immediate results from shareholders?
It absolutely is a profound differentiator. This family-controlled structure allows for what we've called patient capital decisions. Think about investing billions in a multi-year store renovation for Tiffany's flagship, or patiently nurturing a smaller, promising brand for a decade before it reaches significant profitability. These are the kinds of long-term investments in brand equity and infrastructure that might be seriously challenged by activist shareholders or quarterly reporting pressures at companies with a more dispersed ownership base.
Short-termism versus long-termism.
Exactly. The Arnault family's control allows them to prioritize multi-generational value creation, and that is a rare and powerful advantage in modern capitalism.
The question of leadership and legacy is incredibly significant here. It hangs over everything. So how exactly does this family control manifest in LVMH's corporate governance and strategic execution day to day? Not just a large shareholder, it's a controlling interest, right?
That's right. It's control. The Arnault family, primarily through their holding company, Christian Dior SE, held 48.6% of LVMH shares, but controlled a staggering 64.3% of the voting rights as of 2023, due to double voting rights for long-term shareholders in France.
54% of the votes. That's decisive.
Absolutely decisive. This deep controlling stake ensures that the family's long-term strategic vision can be implemented without significant external interference. It provides remarkable strategic consistency and direction over decades. Now, the board of directors reflects this influence. It's chaired by Bernard Arnault himself and includes all five of his children: Delphine, Antoine, Alexandre, Frederic, and Jean. Crucially, however, the board also includes a majority of independent directors, and key committees like performance audit, compensation, and sustainability and governance are chaired by those independent directors to ensure robust oversight and adherence to best practices in corporate governance. So it's a blend of strong family vision and independent scrutiny.
This controlling stake clearly ensures the family's long-term vision remains intact. That consistency is powerful. But for an empire of this magnitude, the question of succession, of the next generation stepping into leadership roles. It's always a focal point for investors, for observers, for everyone, really. What insights do our sources give us into that process? How is it being managed?
Succession is indeed a significant long-term consideration. Of course it is. And while no formal, definitive plan is publicly announced, they keep that close to the chest. Our sources indicate a clear and deliberate process is actively underway. Bernard Arnault is meticulously preparing the next generation. All five of his children hold increasingly senior leadership positions across the group's key divisions, gaining invaluable operational experience at the highest levels.
Let's just run through their current roles again, because these aren't just ceremonial positions, are they? These are truly significant operational and P&L responsibilities they hold.
Not at all ceremonial. These are high-stakes, demanding roles. Delphine Arnault is the chairman and CEO of Christian Dior Couture. That's the second largest brand in the group, a critical position. Antoine Arnault serves as the group's chief image and environment officer, a key role for brand reputation and sustainability, and he's also chairman of Loro Piana. Frederic Arnault is the CEO of LVMH Watches, overseeing a newly consolidated and strategically important division. Alexandra Arnault is the executive vice president, product and communications at Tiffany & Co., playing a major part in that crucial turnaround and growth strategy. And Jean Arnault is the marketing and development director for Louis Vuitton's watches division, gaining experience at the group's flagship brand in a growing category. Now, this isn't just symbolic nepotism. It's effectively a multi-year, real-world audition process for executive leadership, a proving ground.
A very high-stakes audition.
Extremely. By entrusting his children with significant operational and P&L responsibilities at major maisons, Bernard Arnault can directly assess their executive capabilities, their strategic acumen, their ability to drive results under pressure. This internal bake-off, if you will, significantly mitigates the risk of a failed leadership transition later on. It ensures that the eventual successor or successors are proven, experienced operators who have earned their position within the group's demanding, performance-driven culture. This provides a clear path forward and strong degree of stability for the future. It demonstrates remarkably proactive risk management in what is often a crucial vulnerability for family-controlled enterprises.
That's a remarkably proactive and structured approach to ensuring continuity and managing what could otherwise be a very challenging transition down the line. But even with such a formidable structure and such careful planning, there are always inherent risks in any global enterprise. You can't eliminate risk entirely. What are some of the potential threats LVMH navigates? How do they balance these against their undeniable strengths?
Right.
While LVMH undoubtedly possesses a robust and resilient business model, it's certainly not without its vulnerabilities and risks. First, its macroeconomic and cyclical sensitivities. You've touched on this. As a producer of highly discretionary luxury goods, its performance is inherently linked to the health of the global economy. A significant economic downturn, a sharp decline in asset values, or sustained high inflation as we've seen impacting aspirational consumers could reduce overall consumer spending and hit profitability.
It's still selling things people don't strictly need.
Exactly.
And given its immense global footprint and reliance on certain key markets, there must be significant geographic and currency concentration risks, particularly with the critical Chinese market we keep coming back to. Absolutely. There's significant reliance on demand from Chinese consumers, both in mainland China and as affluent tourists globally. It's a huge part of the market. This concentration makes LVMH vulnerable to a prolonged economic slowdown in China, unexpected changes in government policy, or broader geopolitical tensions involving China. On the currency front, LVMH reports its financial results in euros, but generates much of its revenue in other major currencies, US dollar, Japanese yen, Chinese yuan, etc. A strengthening euro, as seen in 2024 and 2025, can have that substantial negative impact on reported revenue and profits when translated back. Even if the underlying business is performing well in local currency terms, this currency translation risk is just a constant factor for a global player like LVMH.
And what about threats to the very heart of the business itself? The brand equity, the desirability factor, how do they manage the potential for dilution or missteps there?
That's a continuous and deeply existential battle in the luxury world. It never stops. The central strategic challenge is managing that paradox of luxury at scale we talked about. Balancing the incessant need for growth with the intrinsic essence of luxury, which is rooted in scarcity, exclusivity, desirability. If you push for too much volume or make a brand too accessible, you could inadvertently dilute its prestige and damage its long-term value. It's a fine line.
Killing the golden goose.
Potentially, yes. There's also execution risk. A creative misstep by a high-profile designer, a product quality crisis, or a poorly managed marketing campaign at a core mega brand like Louis Vuitton or Dior that could have an outsized negative impact on brand perception and sales. The stakes are incredibly high. And of course, counterfeiting remains a persistent threat, damaging reputation and legitimate sales across the entire luxury sector. LVMH invests heavily in combating it.
Finally, regulatory and broader operational risks are always present for such a global giant operating in so many jurisdictions.
Indeed. The group is subject to a complex and ever-evolving web of international regulations spanning trade, labor, environmental laws, data privacy, you name it. New trade tariffs, changes in tax laws, stricter regulations related to supply chain transparency and sustainability, like the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, CSRD, in Europe could increase costs and impact profitability. We saw an example of the reputational damage that can arise from supply chain issues with that Loro Piana subcontractor controversy. It highlights the need for constant vigilance across their vast network. And the succession risk we discussed while being proactively managed still represents a key person risk regarding Bernard Arnault's eventual departure, given his unparalleled influence over decades. It's just a reminder that even the strongest companies face a myriad of challenges. And a balanced understanding requires acknowledging and analyzing these potential threats, not just focusing on the strengths.
So we've dissected the empire. We've understood its formidable strategy, its financial engine, and we've acknowledged its inherent risks. Now let's turn our attention finally to valuation, how the market actually prices this company. LVMH consistently trades at a premium to the broader market, and indeed many of its peers. What does that tell us about how investors perceive its true worth and its place in the investment landscape?
Right. LVMH consistently commands that premium valuation. And generally, analysts agree it's justified by its superior, more consistent growth, its robust profitability, and its strong competitive position, those moats we discussed. If we look at the trailing 12 months multiples, say as of August 2025, just for context, LVMH's enterprise value to EBITDA stands around 11.8x. Its price to earnings or PE ratio is about 22.1x. This is alongside that operating margin of 23.1% and return on equity of 17.5%. Strong numbers in isolation. But they gain much more context when you compare them to its rivals.
Okay, so how does LVMH's valuation stack up against its key publicly traded rivals like Hermès, Kering, and Richemont? What are the key differences that explain any premiums or discounts between them?
It creates a pretty clear hierarchy in the market's perception. Hermès, for example, trades at a substantial premium, even to LVMH. Think EBITDA around 31.4x, PE of 48.4x, and a remarkable operating margin near 42%, ROE of 29.1%.
Wow, those are huge multiples for Hermès.
Huge. This reflects its ultra-exclusive positioning, that artificial scarcity model, and unparalleled pricing power. It's seen as a pure play and absolute luxury, almost in a class of its own. Kering, on the other hand, is generally valued lower. Maybe EBITDA around 14.3x, PE 32.1x, but with a lower operating margin closer to 15% and ROE of just 5.9% recently. So LVMH trades at a significant premium to Kering, justified by its superior, more consistent financial performance, higher margins, better ROIC, and that broader diversification and resilience. Richemont sits somewhere in between. EBITDA maybe 15.4x, PE 22.5x, similar to LVMH there. Operating margin around 25%, ROE 17.9%. So LVMH trades at a modest premium to Richemont, perhaps reflecting its greater scale and broader luxury portfolio beyond just hard luxury. And the discount LVMH trades at relative to Hermès, it really reflects two very distinct investment propositions. LVMH is about broad luxury growth and diversification across multiple categories. Hermès is concentrated absolute pinnacle luxury with unparalleled pricing power and a perceived even lower risk profile due to its extreme exclusivity. The market assigns a significant premium to Hermès for that purity and scarcity value.
So what does this all mean for someone looking to truly understand the intrinsic value of LVMH? How do we begin to quantify the unquantifiable strength of this company beyond just comparing multiples?
Right. When we talk about intrinsic value, analysts use powerful methodologies to try and distill a company's true worth beyond just market sentiment. Discounted cash flow, or DCF analysis, is a common one. It projects future free cash flows and discounts them back to the present value. For LVMH, this would involve making assumptions about, say, mid-single-digit revenue growth long-term, maintaining those robust operating margins in the 24-26% range, maybe a terminal growth rate aligned with global GDP and inflation, perhaps 2.0-3.0%, and using a weighted average cost of capital, or WACC, maybe around 6.5% based on their risk profile and capital structure. But for a sprawling conglomerate like LVMH, another approach is often incredibly insightful. Sum of the parts, or SOTP analysis.
Okay, and why is an SOTP analysis particularly well-suited for a company like LVMH, with its incredibly diverse portfolio across those six divisions?
It's particularly well-suited here precisely because LVMH isn't a single homogeneous business. It's six very distinct business segments, each with its own market dynamics, growth prospects, risk profile, and competitive landscape. SOTP allows analysts to value each of those segments separately. They might compare wines and spirits to a pure-play beverage company like Diageo or Pernod Ricard, or fashion and leather goods to other luxury apparel firms like Moncler or Prada, using comparable market multiples for each part. This can often reveal if the market is accurately valuing the collective power of these diverse parts when looking at the consolidated multiples, or if there is perhaps hidden value when you break it down. It properly accounts for the distinct characteristics of each business unit.
But even with these sophisticated financial models, DCF, SOTP, there's always that intangible element we keep coming back to, isn't there? The pure, irreplaceable brand value itself. These quantitative models must still miss something fundamental about LVMH.
Precisely, you've hit the nail on the head. A purely quantitative valuation, by its very nature, struggles to capture the most significant asset on LVMH's balance sheet, which isn't even fully reflected there under accounting rules. And that asset is the immense, the irreplaceable value of its brand portfolio. Brands like Louis Vuitton, Christian Dior, Tiffany & Co., Dom Perignon, these aren't just trademarks or product lines, they are cultural institutions. They have deep historical roots, profound narratives, powerful emotional resonance with consumers. And all that translates into unparalleled pricing power, consistently high margins, and a durable competitive advantage that is almost impossible for anyone else to replicate. This intangible brand equity, though incredibly difficult to put a precise number on, is arguably the primary justification for the premium valuation LVMH consistently commands from the market. And it raises that important question again. How do you truly quantify the unquantifiable power of a brand like Louis Vuitton? These models attempt to proxy it, but the true essence of LVMH's enduring value lies beyond just the spreadsheet numbers. It's in that deeply embedded, coveted brand equity.
That's a crucial point, and it beautifully brings us to our final summary of the LVMH investment thesis, pulling all these threads together. For anyone listening, looking to understand the enduring power of this company, what are the core investment strengths? What truly makes this company so compelling?
Okay, summarizing the core strengths. First, its unrivaled brand portfolio. LVMH owns an unparalleled collection of 75 of the world's most desirable luxury brands. That creates a deep and wide competitive moat that is nearly impossible to replicate. Second, it boasts a diversified and resilient model, structured across 6 distinct segments, multiple price points, global geographies, providing significant resilience against downturns in any single category or region. Third, it has a superior financial profile, an exceptional long-term track record of delivering strong, profitable growth, high returns on invested capital, and that prodigious free cash flow generation we talked about. Fourth, it exhibits dominant market leadership. As the largest player, it benefits from immense scale advantages in real estate, marketing, supply chain, talent acquisition, reinforcing its position. And finally, fifth, proven long-term management under the Arnault family, providing that consistent strategic vision focused relentlessly on brand desirability and value creation over decades.
Okay, those are formidable strengths. But as we discuss, even with these, there are concerns and risks. How are those concerns, things like cyclicality or succession risk, mitigated in LVMH's specific context?
Right. The mitigating factors are important. The cyclicality and China exposure are indeed concerns, yes. But they are significantly mitigated by LVMH's increasing focus on top-tier, less cyclical, wealthy clients, coupled with its broad geographic diversification and the undeniable resilience of its core mega brands even in challenging times. Key person and succession risk, while inherently present in any family-controlled empire, is, as we saw, being actively mitigated by that deliberate multi-year process of integrating the next generation of the Arnault family into key senior operational roles. Ensuring a smooth and experienced transition path seems highly likely. And the paradox of scale, that challenge of balancing growth with exclusivity, is mitigated by a highly decentralized brand management structure, a consistent strategy of price elevation across brands, and a relentless focus on craftsmanship and quality, all designed to maintain that elusive aura of scarcity and desirability.
So as we look to the future, wrapping things up, what are the critical factors for LVMH's continued performance and success? What should listeners really keep an eye on if they're following the company?
I'd point to 4 crucial factors to watch. First, the sustained health of the fashion and leather goods engine. The continued desirability, innovation, and profitable growth of Louis Vuitton and Christian Dior remain absolutely paramount, as they are the primary cash generators fueling the entire group. Second, a sustained recovery in Chinese demand, both domestically and from tourism. This is probably the most significant near to medium-term catalyst for potentially accelerated growth across the group. Third, continued success in hard luxury. particularly the integration and growth trajectory of Tiffany & Company alongside Bulari. Leveraging recent investments and capitalizing on their strong brand equity is key. And finally, fourth, generational relevance. LVMH's ability to effectively engage with millennial and Gen Z consumers, adapting to their values around sustainability, digital experience, and authenticity, will ultimately determine long-term market share and brand longevity. They need to keep winning over the next generation.
Absolutely. If you've ever wondered about the enduring power of luxury and what makes a company truly resilient in the face of constant change, LVMH really does offer a masterclass in strategic execution. It demonstrates how to build, and perhaps more importantly, sustain an empire of desire for generations. So we've journeyed through the intricate, often glittering world of LVMH today. We've dissected its incredibly diversified empire, its unparalleled brand-building strategies, its formidable financial prowess, and how it deftly navigates both global challenges and shifting consumer desires. We've seen how a relentless commitment to heritage and creative excellence, backed by immense financial strength and that truly long-term patient vision, can forge what appears to be an almost unstoppable force in the global economy.
Yeah, and this deep dive, we truly hope, has maybe transformed how you see not just LVMH itself, but perhaps the entire luxury industry. It's really about recognizing the deliberate, the patient strategic choices, the profound understanding of human aspiration, and the meticulous cultivation of desirability that goes into building and sustaining a collection of the world's most coveted brands, making them so much more than just products, but enduring cultural assets.
So here's a final thought to leave you with. In a world increasingly driven by digital trends, by fleeting fads, by instant gratification, what does LVMH's enduring commitment to heritage, to craftsmanship, to that elusive art de vivre, really tell us about the ultimate human desire for authenticity and lasting value? Something to ponder, perhaps, as you look at the brands around you every day.